Welcome. Welcome back after a very long time. I wonder whether you recall what we have considered in this lecture so far. So it is what is it all about? So I guess it's about optimization. Yeah? So you have a program, you want to improve on it. So in order to do so, you have to fix what kind of programs we are talking about. And that was the first thing which we did. This was this tiny language. And then we thought, if you want to optimize, we at least want to make sure that optimization is changing the program, that the changed program has the same meaning as the original program. So therefore, we descended to kind of come up with a semantics of our language. So, and we tried to keep that semantics as simple as possible so that the mathematical overhead is as small as possible. And we did so by, what did we do? We kind of said, what is the program state and what happens at a step? So that was the key ingredient or the key building block of our semantics. And then we said program execution consists of a sequence of steps. And so by this sequence of steps, the program state is successively transformed from an initial state into a final state. So that was our simple model of program semantics. And that is what we will consider here throughout the lecture. And then we came up with one simple idea how to improve a program. And the improvement was as follows. We observed that in programs, at least on the intermediate code level, we often observe that or notice that the same arithmetic expression is repeatedly evaluated. And the main reason for that is that we have index expressions for addressing arrays. And if the same array is addressed several times, the same index expressions might be evaluated again and again and again. And so we came up with an idea of an analysis which kind of provides us with the information whether at a particular program point an expression, say x plus y, has been evaluated on all paths reaching that program point. So that was this A of U, if U is the program point. A means availability of expressions. And we, what does it help us? It helps us if the expression is available, we need not reevaluate it, but just look it up. And for that, we had an initial triggering information by storing the values of such expressions in some auxiliary. And then we just would, then this particular repeated computation would assign the same, would reevaluate the expression and assign it again to the same auxiliary. And so this simply would be like doing nothing because it would override an auxiliary with the value which is already inside the auxiliary. Yeah, and that then we can simply remove that second evaluation and replace it by no op. That was the optimization we had in mind. And now everything, are you fine with that? You recall that? That's the story, so to speak. And now we are at the point when we say, okay, we know how to remove, to cancel out an expression, an assignment at an edge. Okay, that we can do. But the only thing which we are, the kind of the hole in the whole argument is how can we compute this stupid set of available expressions? Yeah? And that if there is just a single execution path, we can do it. Because we said, okay, when there's an edge, we know how the set is changed. If there's an edge and there is an... so maybe I may look at that. Where was that? Here you see, let me see, we had kind of here. So we had put up rules how along an edge the set of available expression changes. So that we might have a look at again because that is now important. So if there at the edge there is the no-op operation, then the set of available expressions does not change. if you have a guard and there is a non-trivial expression E in the guard, then one can say, okay, everything which is available before is also available, and now this new expression E also must be evaluated, and we can store it away in an auxiliary, so therefore it is available afterwards as well. Yeah? And then we also said, if you have an assignment, then the right-hand side is evaluated. We may store it away in auxiliary, so it is available. But X is overwritten by the assignment, so everything which contains X is no longer available. Yeah, so that is this expression. And then we noticed that we also have to deal with memory lookup and reading and writing to memory. And here we see the address expression E is evaluated, yes, so it is added to the set A, but X changes its value, so every expression containing X must be removed. And then the last rule was this memory, the writing to memory. There we have an expression giving the address and an expression giving the value, and those expressions are evaluated, so therefore they could be added to A. But no program variable changes, and therefore nothing is removed. So these were our rules, how along a single edge the set changes. And now the question is, can we extend that single edge computation to something globally? Yeah, say, telling us for a program point what happens along every path reaching that program point. So that is kind of our challenge which we have to meet now. Okay? So, and now the idea is, so what can we do? So, the only thing what we can try to do is to formalize our problem in a neat way. And then perhaps we can find a general problem solver to whom we can offer our problem formulation, and the general problem solver will solve it. So what is the right formulation for our general problem solver? So we don't know what the general problem solver is, but we can try with a nice formalization. So here is the formalization, and that is, the idea is that we kind of collect, we don't know the solution, the A use, these sets, but we may put up constraints which these sets should satisfy. So what are the constraints? So here is, perhaps we start with that constraint. So that is kind of perhaps the most important one. If you have an edge in the control flow graph, this is this K. Then this K, we know what happens along this K, this edge. We know how, if you give me the value at the start point of the edge, I can tell you what will be the set at the end point of the edge. So this relates, so the edge relates kind of the set before and after. And this is expressed in this green box. So it tells me that assume that the edge goes from U to V, and it has a transformation of the sets, which is this, which is that function. And then if I apply this transformation to the value which I have for U, then I get the value at V. But I do not get exactly the value at V, because there could be several ingoing edges to the V. Yeah, and that means, okay, so the value at V should be valid with respect to every ingoing edge. And we want to have available expressions which are available along every edge. So they must arrive along every edge. So if along edge 1 in comes two expressions, and along edge 2, two other expressions, and I have to do the intersections of those. So the only thing which I can guarantee is that the set at program point V is contained in the incoming set. Because another incoming set may cancel it out. I must take the intersection. So therefore this inclusion. Yeah? So now I do not have inequality or something, but an inclusion constraint for every edge. And additionally, I know something more about the start point of the program. At the start point, nothing is available. So that I know. And that gives me this information about the start edge I collect in this constraint. So it is also an inclusion constraint because, well, so in that case, if I have something which is included in the empty set, okay, so then it is the empty set. Yeah, but I have to make these constraints as similar as possible, I put this inclusion constraint there as well. So it is not wrong at least. And now you see that what we have here is, so we have unknowns. So let us look at, so this is, I hope you agree with me that these are side conditions which our sets which we want to assign to every program point should satisfy. Yeah? And let us now look at this kind of what I have written down in a formal setting. So that means these things here, this one and that one and that one, are placeholders for unknown sets. And this is a known transformation. Yeah? Namely, take the intersection, add a particular element x plus y and intersect with all expressions containing set. Yeah? So the k is a known function, but all others are unknown. So in that sense, it is an equation system which you may have for linear programming. You know, who has ever looked at linear programming? No? No one has looked at linear programming? This is a shame. Because I like to say that there are a few algorithms in computer science which are really important, and linear programming is one of them. Because I guess all these calculation and planning which you do in a company is all linear programming. So that one should know. But anyway, but another thing which is perhaps simpler is just linear equations. So there you do not have inequations, but equations. But still you have the same thing. You have, in some sense, each linear, so I write it down. So x equals, it's not like that. X plus 5 y equals 7 and minus 2x minus y equals minus 3. Something like that. I just have dreamt it up. But you see, it is in some sense of the same shape. Every equation states a property which the solution should kind of meet. And then the goal is, then we are happy that there are some mathematicians who have deeply thought about such kind of equations and came up with a technique to deal with it. And dealing with it means giving us information, what is a solution, is whether there are many solutions, is there a single solution, how can I find a solution? Yeah? And here we have the same. We have now not equations, but inequations, but we have also unknowns, and we have statements which kind of relate these unknowns, and it's now, if you like, a mathematical problem or an algorithmic problem to find the solutions. Yeah. So, and now the question is, so that is what we would like to have. So, if you think we kind of, for our goal to optimize our program, we take every means which we have, and even if it's mathematics. And so we want someone to give us a method to determine the solutions. Now, the first question what a mathematician would ask if he gets such a system: is there a single solution? Is there always a solution? Are there multiple solutions? Are there specific solutions? So, from an application point of view, assuming that that is this all the solutions of this constraint system are admissible in that sense that they allow us to do the transformation, then we might wonder what is the best solution for our application. What is the best solution for our application? So remember, a solution is a set of expressions for every U. Now, what is the best solution which we could hope for? The largest, if the sets are as large as possible. Why? Then if we know more sets which are available at program points, we can trigger more optimizations. Okay? Can we understand that? The more expressions are available, the more opportunities we have to improve the program. So what is the worst solution which we could have?
The empty set.
The empty set for every program point. And then, so this is clear. So that, and is the empty set a solution for this constraint system? It is, because then we have empty set on all left-hand sides, and no matter what the right-hand sides do, all constraints are satisfied. So there is, we immediately see there is always a solution, and which is extremely boring. We cannot make use nothing of it. So that's not the one which we are interested in. So if someone says, is this solvable, give me a solution, then we can do it with a finger snip, but it's useless. So that therefore we have to work harder, and working harder means getting a larger solution. And the best would be the largest, if such a thing exists, and if we can compute it. Yeah. So that is now what we would like to have, this algorithm. And now let us look at here this little example, which is the factorial function, and we might wonder what the... just for to illustrate what we are doing. And so here is I write down now the constraints which kind of we would put up for this control flow graph. So now recall there was one constraint which we had for the start point. So this is zero. And there we state that there the set is the empty set. So here it is. So then we have one for the edge from zero to one that gives us this constraint here. And it tells us, so at the edge from 0 to 1, there is this, the right-hand side which is evaluated is the consists only of the constant 1. Speaking aside, it is debatable whether we would consider that as an interesting expression. So if we do not consider it an interesting expression, we would add nothing here. So, but here for the moment, we consider it even this constant as an interesting expression, which the analysis would kind of keep track of. So, therefore, this is added to the set of available expressions at the start point of the edge, which is the point zero. So, therefore, one, the expression one is added to the must be added to the set at program point zero, and then everything, so this is assignment to y, and then everything containing y must be removed from the values at program point zero, and then we get something which the endpoint is contained in. Yeah, but you see here this endpoint one has two ingoing edges, so it need not be the same, it could be a subset of it. Because there is another ingoing edge, namely this one from program point 4, and the program point 4, there is a knob operation there. Therefore, this is an inclusion constraint. So now so that should kind of explain to you these two constraints for the program point 1. So note here that I do no simplification. It's just syntactical one-to-one writing down the definition, because you all have already noticed A0 is zero, the set 0, and so therefore I could replace this one with the empty set and make such kind of optimization. Clearly I can do it, but I can do that is already doing something manually, and this is already part of the solving. And here I do not want to solve, I just want to write down what must be solved. Okay? So just to separate, to clarify the steps. The first thing is we write down the constraints, and then we do the solving. Okay. So that is this first edge, and then we have to proceed for all the other edges, so for all the other program points. So for program point two, there's one ingoing edge. And the ingoing edge, so it is a guard, and so we add the predecessor point, the values at the predecessor point, together with the guard. And then we proceed to program point three. There is this assignment. Let us look at that in once again a little bit more carefully. At that edge, so we add the right-hand side, and we must remove everything depending on Y. Okay? Then we may go to the next one. So this is, there's again, this expression is the right-hand side, which we add, and this is removed. And so these, for program points 2 and 3 and 4, it is so there's only one ingoing edge, therefore there's only one constraint. And for 5, it's again, there is only one ingoing edge, therefore only one constraint. Okay? So that we can put up. And now, the question is, how can we solve it? So, as we already have discussed, there are simplification methods, possibilities. So, for example, if we have such a thing, then we know the value A of 0, and then we can substitute it all over the place. And things like that. So that we could do. But here are cyclic dependencies. Because there's a cyclic, there is a cycle in the control flow graph. And we see if there's a cycle in the control flow graph, then we have cyclic dependencies. So for example, 1. So, where is it? So 4. 4 influences, here, this one. 4 influences 1, 1 influences 2, 2 influences 3, 3 influences 4, and 4 influences 1. So there's a cyclic dependency. So in somehow, just by propagating constants, so to speak, I would not solve that system. But there is a solution, and that is the solution, and it is the greatest solution. So in this example, we can kind of invent it somehow and dream it up and check whether it is so. So for whether it is a solution at least. And so we see, for example, okay, so in the end, this solves the case for the program point 0. For program point 1, only the expression 1 is available. Why? It is computed along one ingoing edge. It comes along that. What is it? Here it is computed once, and then during that cycle it is not removed, and so therefore it stays somehow. And it and so on. And so in the end, so that is kind of, we have no idea, so we can check just by plugging these values, these sets, into this constraint system whether really everything, all the constraints are met. Yeah, but here, from the application point of view, we may stare at that solution and check whether there's any opportunity for improving the program, and then, bad luck, there's no opportunity. But that is, in some sense, to be expected, because there is no repeated evaluation of an expression, so it would be really a miracle if we would find an opportunity for improvement, if we found an opportunity for improvement. So, in that sense, no surprise, but at least we can do the analysis. Okay? So now, this solution was heavenly given. That is not the way how we would like to do it. We would like to have a kind of systematic way. And so if we think again of the system of equations over the rationals or over any field, in order to compute a solution, you all know, at least that I kind of I take for granted, that you know how to solve a linear system of equations. There are several methods, and you know some of them. And why do these methods work? Because you have, you and those people who have kind of come up with these methods have studied the rational numbers and their properties of arithmetic, and then they know the rules how to compute with numbers, and so by that they found a way to apply these rules to kind of simplify the systems, the equations in the system until a solution can be read off, or all solutions can be read off. So therefore, we have to study the application in order to come up with the algorithm. And here it means we have constraints. So if we have general constraints, we have no idea what to do. But here it is constraints between sets. And so we might wonder whether we can exploit particular properties of sets. Now, what are the particular properties of sets? So here is what we have. So the possible values for our unknowns are sets of expressions. Yeah, sets. So this is the set of possible values. And now the question is, how can we compute with sets? What do we know about sets? So the first thing is that there's an ordering on sets. So there are larger sets and there are smaller sets. And therefore, it is for that reason that we can speak about something like there is a best solution. Namely, that one with the largest sets. Yeah? And now if we kind of try, so that is another thing which at least what computer scientists immediately do when they observe such a particular thing, like these constraints between sets, then they might say, okay, I can now go for a particular algorithm for available expressions. But that is a bit boring because now then comes another optimization, another analysis, and we are doomed and start from scratch. So we would like to abstract it a little bit in the hope that the more abstract interface, so to speak, may fit to other applications as well, and can then arrive at kind of a general problem solver for our application domain. So therefore, instead of saying, okay, we have a set and set inclusion, we could consider it as an instance of a more general structure, which is a complete lattice. So a complete lattice somehow is the same as the set of all subsets, but a little bit more abstract. And there are other instances which are not sets, which also fit into this framework. Okay. And that is the first thing, and I will briefly, in a minute, start to explain to you how these complete lattices what one requires for these. And then there's a second property which we will exploit, namely that these transformations which we have assigned to the control flow edges, these are transformations on sets for the available expressions, which in some sense respect the ordering. So this means if you feed in something larger, then you get out something larger. Or at least not something smaller. Yeah. So that would be because somehow these... So that is kind of a monotonicity property. And these two properties together, that we have a complete lattice, and that these transformations for the edges are monotonic. These two pieces together suffice to come up with an algorithm for solving these kind of analysis problems. And that is kind of for solving such kind of constraint systems. And that is kind of the key message which we will now work on, and which we then can apply to available expressions, but it would be, because it's not only about sets but about complete lattices, we will be able to use that for all our analysis problems here. So in that sense, we have one ingenious algorithm which solves all our problems. So that one would like to have in many other areas as well, but in many other areas we are not as lucky as here. So now what are complete lattices? So when I explain to it, there are Okay, so it's a kind of a mathematical structure, but if you want to kind of remember it, always kind of think of two instances. One instance of a complete lattice is the set of all subsets of a set, and the other instance is which we will see two more instances of that. And you should, if you remember these examples, then you can recover the properties of a complete lattice by taking those properties which have those examples in common. So the first thing is, a complete lattice is a partial order with a little bit more extra properties. So now, what is a partial order? So partial order is something, but that, has never heard the word partial order? Okay, so then this is very easy to tell you. So this is, you have reflexivity, you have transitivity, no, you have symmetry, anti-symmetry. So this means if A is less or equal to B and B is less or equal to A, then they are the same. What would symmetry mean? Yeah, that definitely does not hold, but it holds only for equality relations. So symmetry is not, we cannot hope for, but this anti-symmetry. So if we have the case that they are in, that both are in relation to each other, then they are equal. So that is kind of a useful property. And then we have transitivity. So this means if one is less or equal to the other, and that is less or equal to a third thing, then you have a transitive less or equal relation as well. Okay, and before we kind of add the extra piece which we need for a complete lattice, let us kind of review a few examples which fall into that partial order framework. So the subset relation, the set of all subsets of a base set together with the subset relation is such a partial order. And typical or often when we draw pictures, we use these kind of diagrams. So what do these how can these diagrams be read? But probably it's just for a convention, you probably know, but I just repeat, or you may tell me, how is did I draw this partial order when I make this picture? How is it this picture to be understood? So inclusion goes upward. So that is the first thing. And I kind of, by that, omitted the arrows, so to speak. And then there's also, I only wrote down immediate inclusion relations. So that is something which is a little one step larger. And if I want, so this set, for example, is the empty set. This is clearly included in these three sets, but it is also included in everything which you can reach by an upward path. Yeah? So that that means that I have not written down the transitivity in order to have a not-so-dense graph. Otherwise, the graph would be extremely dense. Yeah, but that is kind of, I think that should be this kind of diagrams you should have seen already, and they are quite familiar to you. Okay? So that it's not every partial order which you can draw in this way, but many. And for the examples, it is good enough. Okay. Then there is that was the subset relation, the set of all subsets, the power set, if you like, together with the subset relation. That was fine. Now here's another. Here are three more examples which are interesting. So it looks a bit weird because there is no edge at all. So that means that if you have two distinct elements, they are in no relation. And that is also a partial order because everything is only in relation if it's the same. So zero is only comparable with zero. And with one, there is no relation at all. And so the relation of that form is the equality. And this is also a partial order relation, but clearly this is a partial order relation which is symmetric, and so in that sense it's an equality. Yeah. Okay. So this is a particular case. Then another case is that sometimes these partial orders are infinite. That is also something which does not come at a surprise. So here for the integers, for example, with the natural ordering relation, this is a partial order. And I have only, and so because I was unable to draw all of them, I put only four, and I made it a little bit with a slope so that you see it goes up in one direction. And then there is another interesting thing which looks a bit weird. You have the integers as before, but together with an extra element, namely this bottom element, and this bottom element is below the integers, and that's all. So there is no other thing. So in that sense, this is, if you like, you take that and add this bottom element, and then these things, and then you arrive from this partial order 2 to the partial order 4. And that is not while some people use it. So that is not a completely stupid thing. Now the question is, what does this bottom element mean? In some sense, the idea is there that you may think of that this is the value, or it's somehow undefined, or not yet, it represents a not yet computed value. If you have a program which returns whenever it terminates a number, then as long as it has not yet terminated, it has the value bottom, undefined, and as soon as it terminates, it returns a value 1, 2, 3, 4, or minus 5. Yeah? And then you proceed from bottom to a value. So that kind of behavior is modeled by this partial order. So therefore, this partial order 4 is not completely useless. Okay. So now, so these were examples. Now, what can we do with partial order? So there's another notion which is useful for us, and this is the notion of an upper bound for a set. For numbers, it is clear what it means, an upper bound. If you have 1, 2, 3, what is an upper bound? 3. Or 4, or 5, or 6. So the same set could have several upper bounds. And so I think in numerical, these numerical people, they try to find tight upper bounds for certain things, and also for in computer science, it's often a hot topic to find something which is a tight upper bound to some values. So that is a notion which you can define generally for any partial order. So you are given a set and you want to find an element which is larger than any element of the set. Now the question, such a thing does not, in a partial order, such a thing need not always exist. Yeah, think of here, in that particular example, this one and that one, two elements, but with respect to that order, there is no element which is larger than both of them. So it's not so that in every partial order you have for every subset upper bounds. For some sets you might have upper bounds. Let us check here. For these two elements, there is an upper bound. What is an upper bound? 2. 2 is at least as large as bottom and at least as large as 2, so that would be an upper bound. Yeah. And now then let us make another attempt here at that example. These three elements, do they have an upper bound? Sure. There is this. 1 is an upper bound, 2 is an upper bound, 3, and so on. There are many upper bounds. So upper bounds are not unique. But here in this particular case, there is something which is an interesting phenomenon. There is something, at least for this particular set, there is something like a least upper bound, which is an upper bound and which is completely tight, and this least upper bound is then this one thing. And this is unique. So this is a nice property in this example. But it's not clear. It's not so that it is available in all partial orders, but it is available here. And then there's another thing that now I may ask: is it so the case that every subset of elements of set have an upper bound? Now, what do you think?
I would say that if you take the entire set of set, that's also a subset of set, and that doesn't have an upper bound.
Yes. So every finite subset has an upper bound, obviously, but every infinite set. No, that's not true. There are also infinite sets which have an upper bound, namely, for example, all negative numbers. So they have an upper bound, namely minus one. But there are infinite sets which have no upper bound, namely, for example, all numbers, because there is no number which is at least as big as every other number. That is the essence of integers, that there is no upper bound to all of them. In order to obtain and to make it in that sense complete, we would have to add an infinity, for example, to have an upper bound also for all numbers, and perhaps even a minus infinity to have a lower bound also for all subsets of numbers. Okay, so so that was kind of the thing. So in that sense, we see upper bounds are perhaps nice, but it's not necessarily the case that they exist. And then there's the nicest thing which one could think of in terms of upper bounds is if there is not only any upper bound, but there is something which is the best upper bound, and that is the least one. And we have already seen that for some of these examples, there are subsets of elements in some of these partial orders which have no upper bound. And here, in this particular case, there are many upper bounds, and there is in particular a least upper bound, and that is this one. Okay, now what is a complete lattice? A complete lattice is something which is completely well-behaving with respect to upper bounds. And that means that simply for every subset, there is a least upper bound. That is the only extra thing which comes which makes a complete lattice. So for every subset, we have an upper bound, and in particular, not only any upper bound, but a least one. And that least upper bound we sometimes denote by this square something. And in some sense, you could think of this one is obtained, is a mixture of this symbol and that symbol. You take the average of these two and somehow arrive at that. Something like that. Yeah? So it should remind you to the less or equal sign of the integers and the union of the and the union of set union, and that kind of should, so that you could kind of remind you, and also the ordering relation in a complete lattice is this one, which should also remind you of set inclusion. And this one, and you take a half of it, and that you get it, the average. Think like that. Yeah. So, in this sense, one tries to be abstract, and that's when speaks about general complete lattices. But you should, in order to recover the properties, you should have these two examples somehow in mind. Okay. So now. So that now you know all, you know the definition of a complete lattice. Now let us briefly see what kind of extra properties complete lattices have. And so the first observation is that every complete lattice has a greatest element. And how does one obtain this greatest element? Simply, one takes the least upper bound to the whole set of all values. So as it is, this all elements in the complete lattice are a subset, and so they must have a least upper bound, and that is the greatest element. And there's also something like a least element, namely this is the least upper bound to the empty set. The empty set also must have a least upper bound, and that is this bottom element. So this least element will always denote it by that element, and the greatest element or top element by this one. Okay, so this is available in all complete lattices. And now let us quickly look at our examples and see which of them are complete lattices and what are the least and what is the bottom and what is the top element of these. So clearly, this one, as I said, this least upper bound operation is kind of taken from, is abstracted away from set union. So there is a least upper bound operation on the set of subsets of a... there is, for every subset of subsets, there is a least upper bound. So let us see it briefly. So I have... A, B, C, and perhaps AC, and I want to have the least upper bound of all these things. Now I make it like that, and you see the least upper bound is just the union of these, and that is, you have to collect all the elements which are mentioned in any of these sets. This is ABC. So the least upper bound of a, if you have given a few subsets and you want to have a common superset, which is the smallest possible, then you simply take the union. That is kind of the way how you determine the least upper bound for in this complete lattice of power set of sets of all set subsets. Okay, so now with if you have for this the integers together with equality, this is not a complete lattice for the simple reason that if I have 1 and 2, there is no common upper bound at all, and so there is also no least upper bound. And for if you take the also integers now not with equality as the ordering relation, but with the natural relation of less or equal, then this is also no complete lattice, because as we have seen, there is no top element and there is no bottom element, and we would have to add them in order to obtain a complete lattice. And then find the next example is this one, where we take the integers and put just the bottom below. This is fine, but this is also not yet a complete lattice, because still 1 and 2 have no upper bound. And thank you. So therefore, in order to obtain a complete lattice around the integers, where all the integers are incomparable, we have not only to put a bottom below, but also a top on top, and then we may have the incomparable ints in between, and that would be a complete lattice. Yeah, if you have two distinct elements of the integers, then the least upper bound is top, and if you if you have any subset of integers which does not contain just one element but more than one element, then their least upper bound is top, and if it's just a singleton, then the least upper bound is the singleton, and so by that you get a complete lattice. So it seems to be a trivial one, but it's not completely uncommon to use this lattice. Yeah. So you could think of it as computationally, maybe this kind of gives an intuition. The computation is not yet finished, so you are still undefined. Then computation might return a value, then you are here, or it may even crash and give an exception, and then you are here. So in that sense, in certain computational properties, you could model by that kind of lattice. Okay. So this is a complete lattice. And now one would think still these the complete lattices are we define that they are all least upper bounds, and it seems not much more can be said about complete lattices, but that's actually not true. There is something. Complete lattices have strong extra properties. For example, and this I have written down this theorem because it is it comes a little bit as a surprise, at least to me, and it in proving this theorem we get a little bit of a feeling what you can do with complete lattices, and therefore I put it there. So, and the theorem tells us, so if you have once again we have defined a complete lattice that all least upper bounds are there. And the interesting thing is that as soon as all least upper bounds are there, also all greatest lower bounds are there. It is a consequence. We do not have to ask for it. It is given to us for free. And that is the, at least I find, amazing property of these complete lattices. So now, that is the statement. Given that we have all least upper bounds, then we can construct for every subset X also a greatest lower bound. And how can we prove it? So that is again something a little bit philosophical. We have nothing other but that all greatest, that there is a least upper bound. So we can only construct sets and the upper bounds and the least upper bounds, that's all. So in that sense, if there's so little available, then proving is very easy. We can only do the natural thing. So all the proofs are natural. So let us see how such a natural proof would look like. So here's the idea. So now we are given X, and we are asked to provide a greatest lower bound. So what can we do? So we can kind of collect all lower bounds, whether they exist or not. In the worst case, this set U would be empty. But now, thinking about it, is this set U really empty? Or does U contain some element? What is your guess? Is there always at least one element which is less or equal than any other element in X? And the answer is, yes, there is, because there's a least element. We have convinced ourselves that every complete lattice has a least element, and the property of a least element is that it is less or equal than any other element. So in particular, it is less or equal than any element in X. Yeah? So this U is not empty. So it's not a vacuous thing. So it is there. Yeah? Okay. So then we can think of, so we have X, so we can consider of all these elements which are less or equal than X, than every element in X. So this set we can kind of write down. And now, what is the potential if we want to have a greatest lower bound? What can we do? A greatest lower bound should be something which is greater or equal than anything in U. So it should be an upper bound to U. So let's take the least upper bound and hope that this solves our problem. Yeah, so we come up with a candidate, and which is this G. Take the least upper bound of all lower bounds. And now I hope that this Jesus solves our problem. So I have to prove that this is in fact the greatest lower bound of X. So how can we prove that? Now, the only thing what we have to do is, the first thing is, and the most decisive thing is to prove that G is a lower bound at all. It comes from the lower bounds, but then you take something which is an upper bound to them. So it's not so clear whether G is still a lower bound. So for that, in order to prove, now we have written down what we want to prove, then we can try to prove it. So what does it mean by definition that G is a lower bound to X? It means that whenever I take a little x from x, that this g is less or equal than this little x. So let us look at this x, this little x. Then what we know is that for every lower bound u, that this little u must be less or equal to x. And again, this is by definition, because it's a lower bound to the big X. So it must also be less or equal than any small x. So every little u is less or equal than this X. Now, but that means, according to our definition, that this little X is an upper bound to the big U. Okay, but if little X is an upper bound of the big U, then the least upper bound of the big U must be less or equal to X. So we conclude that this little g is less or equal to the little x. Okay, and that we could do for every little x. And therefore this g is a lower bound to the capital X. So you see, we only use the definitions and put it in this way and in that way, and that's all. Okay, now we have found that this G is really the lower bound, and now we have to check whether it is the greatest lower bound. But that is now very easy, because we have constructed this little g as an upper bound of all u. So that is, if ever I have such a lower bound little u, then this little u is an element of this capital U. And since G is even the least, but still an upper bound to the capital U, this little u is less or equal to G. So therefore, G is at least as big as every little u, and therefore it is greater than any other lower bound greater or equal to any other lower bound of the capital X. And therefore we have now two things. It is G is a lower bound, and it is the greatest lower bound. And that completes the proof. Okay? Any questions? So you see here, as a picture, by definition, this subset X, so this here is the X, has a least upper bound, and now we have proven that it also has a greatest lower bound. So in that sense, it's symmetric upward and downward. Okay, so that was the first thing. Now we have these complete lattices. Now let us come back to our problem. So we have a set of constraints. So the constraints are somehow of this form. We have a left-hand side. This is an unknown. This was this A of U, but I now write unknown. Unknowns are always X, so therefore it's an X. So this was the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side we had a function applied to another unknown. So that we could, why should there only be one unknown on the right hand side? It could be multiple. Yeah, so we assume that there is a function f, which is applied to several other unknowns, and it could also be applied simply to all. Yeah, so it may depend on all other. The right hand side may depend on all other unknowns in the system, and this is this f. Which is applied to that. And there's one little thing here, that I I'm simplify here in that sense that I only have one constraint for every left-hand side. So, and I will come back to that. This is no restriction at all, but it makes it easier to write to write it down simply. So now, in our coming, just to see that this, what I have written down here in the very abstract, that it is, it fits to our problem in so far. So now these unknowns, these x's, these are the four available expressions. These were the sets which we wanted to have for every program point. And then the complete lattice, which we are talking about now, these were the consists. So each element in the complete lattice is a set of expressions. So therefore it is a power set of expressions which we are computing with. And then perhaps here the right hand side here, which determines the xi depending on all other variables, it is constructed like that. You take all ingoing edges for a node V. You apply the transformation for this edge to the predecessor node, and these are all the contributions for the V. And then you take the intersection of these. So that was how we did. So this is now, you see, by this intersection, which we have not written down so far, we kind of combine all the multiple ingoing edges into one constraint. And so that is kind of the and by introducing this intersection, we kind of go from multiple constraints to a single constraint for a left-hand side. Now, this is the, for that reason, it suffices for the moment for our algorithm to consider such a system where we have only, if you have n variables, we have n constraints. And the f's are still, and then I kind of, then there's only one, perhaps, I don't know how weird one should think of it. It's a little bit, it's always a little bit confusing. So here we kind of, the ordering here is opposite somehow. So for, in this particular case, the ordering which, so for, I must say in this way, the way how people solve these systems of equations is typically they start with bottom and then they compute a solution which is as small as possible with respect to the ordering of the complete lattice. So that is what they do in the world of complete lattices. Now in our application, the best solution, in that sense the tightest and smallest, is where the expressions are as large as possible. So therefore we have to kind of put the ordering upside down. So therefore iteration, so therefore the best solution we can hope for should return the largest sets. And in other applications, in other analysis which we will have, it will be as small as possible. So therefore I hope this will confuse you not too much, but if you take the set of all subsets and use as ordering relation, not subset relation, but superset relation, it is effective. It doesn't change the world very much, because at least these subsets, partial orders, are symmetric. If you put them upside down, they look exactly the same. Okay, so this is the slight deviation, which makes it a little bit weird that we always speak of. That here we have this sign and not this side. Okay, so then taking that for having now this, so now we return, retire from the world, from the reality, and go back to the abstract world. We now look at that, and we have complete letters, and we wonder, can we find a method for any complete letters to determine least solution? Yeah, least solution, smallest in the letters, and for our application, where everything is upturned, upside down, this means the greatest solution. Yeah. And perhaps here in the last line, I put here to you a little justification why we can combine multiple constraints for the same variable into a single variable. Namely, if you have multiple constraints, then this means that the same x should be greater or equal to d1 to dk, corresponding to the constraints d1 to dk, and that is exactly the same as if x is an upper bound to the least upper bound of the d1 to dk. And that is kind of the way how we can compute multiple constraints into a single one, in general, for an arbitrary lattice, complete lattice. Okay? Now, so that is, our obligation, algorithmic obligation. We are given such a constraint of such a system, and we want to compute a least solution. And the only requirement which we additionally have, so that we will have two requirements, that the values for the axis are from a complete lattice, and now then there's another assumption on this F, by which we compute the contribution for the left-hand side from the values on the right-hand side. Now, this F should be monotonic. I have said that for individual edges, but I have not yet formally defined what monotonic means. But we have all an opinion about monotonic, and that is exactly that what I will use here. So if I have any function from one, it need not even be a complete lattice, it suffices to be a partial order. If ever I have a mapping from one partial order d1 to another partial order d2, then this is monotonic if it respects the ordering. So this means if A is less or equal to B, and then F of A should also be less or equal to F of B. And we know that for so here I guess are immediately examples. We know that for numbers, for example, if you have the natural ordering on the integers, and then increment is a monotonic function. Yeah, so if you add one, then, and if you add one to a larger number, then the result will be larger. But also decrement is also monotonic. Because if you decrement one from a larger number, you get something which is still larger than that from a smaller number. And not everything is what you can do with numbers is monotonic. Because you could, for example, multiply with -1. And this is the easiest example of something which is not monotonic. Because if you multiply 5 with -1, you get -5. And if you multiply 1 with -1, you get -1. But -1 is larger than -5. So this multiplication with negative numbers inverts the ordering. So therefore, this would be ruled out, such things. Now, that was the world of numbers. Now, what is in the world of sets? A typical monotonic operation. A typical monotonic operation is if you take, if you intersect, or if you union with another set, then this is a monotonic operation. Yeah, because if X is larger, if you put extra elements in X, then the whole thing can only get larger and not smaller. And the obvious function which is not monotonic for sets is which one? This one is obviously not monotonic, because if you put more into X, then you subtract more from A. Yeah, so that would be not monotonic. Okay? But if you, then there's another example which we might write down. Now let me kind of cancel it and write down another example. F of X equals X minus A. Is that monotonic or not monotonic? What do you say? Why not?
Because, for example, if you have two sets A and B, let's say you have two sets X and Y, A doesn't have to be in both of those sets. So if you take it out, it's possible that it wasn't in the set X before, so now you took it out of Y and Y. I'm not sure.
So actually, this is the same as X intersected with a complement of A. So it's an intersection. So if you subtract something, this is also an intersection. If you subtract something from a larger set, cannot get something worse. Yeah. So for example, think of it, I may make it even more concrete, perhaps a little bit more concrete. If I have F of X, X 1, 2. Now if X contains 1, 2, so if you add something to X, if you add 1 to X, for example, then you would remove it. But if you have not, if it was not there before, then it was not, it will not, yeah, so you don't make a difference. And if you add 3 to X, the element 3 to X, then it will be also, the output also will be contain the 3, so the output will get larger. Yeah, so it may be the, so if you have a monotonic function and you have a larger set B, then it does not mean that F of B necessarily is larger than F of A. It could also be equal to F of A, but it can never be smaller. Okay? Do the examples clarify a little bit what this monotonicity means? Okay. Now these monotonic functions are a world of their own, and there are certain properties. And here I just state some of them. So, for example, monotonicity is preserved by composition. So if I have a monotonic function and I compose it with another monotonic function, then altogether it is monotonic. That is something. And then there is, then one can also make, from monotonic functions you can obtain, you can consider all monotonic functions of a particular type. And this again is a partial order, and can be is a complete lattice if that is a complete lattice. If the D2 is a complete lattice, then the set of all monotonic functions D1 to D2 is also a complete lattice. And now so how can we prove it, or what do we have to do? The first thing is we have to define an ordering on functions. And that is perhaps a useful ordering. This is the most trivial ordering, if you like. This is the pointwise ordering. So a function is equal or larger than another function if for every argument it is equal or larger. Yeah. So this is this one. And with respect to that ordering, then you have a complete lattice. And for that, you have to say, in order to prove that it's a complete lattice, you have to provide for every set of functions a least upper bound. So what if you have this capital F, which is a set of functions, how do you define its least upper bound? So this means this little F, for that, how do you find this little F? You have to say, for every little x, for every argument, what is the result? But this is the natural way how to define it. The value of this least upper bound little f should be, for every x, the least upper bound of all the values produced by the capital F, by functions in capital F. And now, if you have that, the only thing what remains to be proven is that this little f indeed is monotonic. That's the only thing which you have to prove. So there's the proof obligation, which I kind of omit here. Show that f is monotonic. Now let us see what here I said once again that these functions, that monotonic functions can be composed and you get again monotonic functions, and that is interesting. So we might wonder what happens if we have this particular for sets, these set functions which you obtain by intersecting with one set and taking the union with another set. What happens if you... So we know now from this other theorem, which we have not proven, but we clearly believe, that that if we compose two such functions, that each of them is monotonic, their composition also should be monotonic. And since all monotonic functions form a complete lattice, so there is something also like union of two, or at least upper bound of two such functions, and intersection, greatest lower bound of two such functions, and only we do not know how these how the results of the composition, least upper bound and greatest lower bound of these of functions of this particular form might look like. And now the point is that in case that our functions f I are of that particular form, that then we can write down explicit formulas for the composition, for the least upper bound and the greatest lower bound in such a way that the result is again of this form A intersected B union A intersected X union B. And here I have kind of written down these formulas. So for composition, you have to do the following. You have to intersect the A's, and you have to intersect the B1 with A2 and take the union with B2. So I have just written it down. And for the union, you have to do the union in both components. And for the intersection, it's a little bit more complicated. You do the intersection here, and you have to use this weird expression there. And now, how... Is it a miracle, or is it a deep insight, or would you have been able to recover it yourself? And the answer is, you definitely would be able to come up with these formulas yourself by how? Let us see, for example, this composition thing. Now let me see where there is a possibility to get in. Here. The composition thing. So how would one do it? So we... Perhaps we do it in black. f2 of f1 of x. So we write down what it is. It is a2 intersected a1 intersected x union b1 union b2. Okay? I just plugged in the definition, and now we simply, you see, this is an expression with union and intersection, and we kind of may beautify it a little bit. So what can we do? So this is, the first thing which we can do is to distribute this intersection over the two arguments to the right. This gives us a1 intersected a2 intersected x union. Now the b1, the a2 must be intersected with b1 and union b2. Okay, and now you see this one is the new a, and this is the new b. And the only thing what I did was applying the distributive laws. And the same holds, the same method kind of also applies to the other cases. So you see, no miracle. It's just you have to boldly apply the definitions. But still, the result is interesting, as it shows that the class of these functions are nice in that sense, as it is closed under composition, under least upper bound and greatest lower bound. Okay? Is there a question? And there are certain algorithms which exploit that fact. And so it is good to know. Because it is good. Why am I insisting so on this particular forms? Because if you look at the forms which we had for the available expressions, it was more or less that form. And this is a very popular format in various kinds of program analysis. And up to a certain point in time, I would say end of the 70s, mid 80s, some practical compiler guys always considered such kind of analysis and nothing else. So that was for them the only kind of analysis which you could do. Okay, so now what is our problem? Once again, so here we have our system of constraints, and now you are, I hope you are not yet bored with it. So the right-hand sides are monotonic. And there's a little bit of a point here that the right-hand sides are not, I have multiple arguments. But that is, you could also consider it as the right-hand sides, so the multiple arguments, x1 to xn, but you could consider it also as a function from d to the n to d, taking a tuple and returning a value. And now this, you, for a second or a microsecond, you might wonder, okay, so d is a complete lattice. What about d to the n? But d to the n is also a complete lattice. And what kind of ordering you would have on a tuple? If you compare two tuples, then one is less or equal to the other, if it is so for every component. So this is the natural way how do you order tuples. Yeah? And in that sense, it is also this, each right-hand side is a mapping from a complete lattice to another complete lattice. And in this sense, we can apply this idea of monotonicity. Now, what can we do then with these, with such things? So the idea is we have one function taking all argument, all xi's and return x1. We have another function which takes all the x1 to xn and returns x2, and so on. So that these are functions, if you like, which provide all a different component of one of the tuple itself. So we could combine all the F1 to Fn into a big F1, into a big F, which takes as an argument a big F, which takes as an argument a tuple of n things and returns a tuple of n things. Yeah? And it is defined in such a way that the ith component of the result tuple is computed by the ith function. So now you wonder, so you probably do not find that very impressive, and it's not impressive, it only tells us, since the dn is a complete lattice, so this is a complete lattice, so this is in fact a function which takes one thing and returns one thing, only it's defined in a complicated way. So it's a monotonic function taking one thing and returning one thing. So we have our problem now actually looks as follows. We are given an x, which is a tuple, and we have one right-hand side f, which takes the x and returns something. And now we wonder, can we... So the only thing which we need to solve is the problem, can we solve one variable constraint? And this makes it perhaps a little bit simpler, because one variable constraint is perhaps something which we can do, if not something more complicated. Yeah? So in this sense, this little argument kind of brings us down to the case when we have just one variable. And now the idea is, if now thinking of this one variable, what can we do? Okay, so what value could be a solution for our system, for our inclusion constraint? So the first idea is, we don't know. So we start with some value and try whether it's a solution. So we start with which value could we start? So if we are interested in a very small solution, it's a good idea to start with the least value, because then we are not, at least not too large. So if this is the best value, so if we are lucky, even the least value is already a solution. So we check. So the idea is we take this bottom element, so I made the underbar to indicate that this is a tuple of bottom values, so this is the least element in this tuple world. So we take that. And now we check, is it a solution? How can we check it? So, well, we take it and plug it into the right-hand side. That means we apply F to it. And if F applied to this tuple of bottom values is again bottom value, we are done. But now it could be that that f applied to bottom is larger than bottom, but it would still be at least as big as the least solution, yeah. So therefore, if we find that f applied to bottom is not bottom, then we know that bottom is not the least solution, is no solution at all. So we have a next candidate, namely this F applied to bottom. And what can we do? So this is a candidate. And now we check, is this a solution or not? How can we do it? We plug it into the right-hand side, evaluate the right-hand side, and see what is the left-hand side. The left-hand side, if it is F of bottom, then we are done. If not, then okay. So then F of F bottom is the next approximate, and so on. So that is our strategy how to do it. We do this iteration. We start with bottom. We insert it into the right-hand side. If we have a solution, we are done. If not, we have the next approximation. And so then we repeat. Okay? And the hope is that eventually we reach a solution. And whether we reach a solution or not, that I tell you next week. So thank you for your attention for today, and okay, so.